Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Nick Freudenberg, who is the author of a great new book called Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. And I'll tell you more about his work in a little while. But before I do that, I want to tell you some things that are going on in the news that I'm sure you all want to know about, as well as ways that you can take some action and help participate in turning things around, which is always a wonderful way to start the day. A wonderful study just came out of Newcastle University that really is one of the first studies that proves organic food is better for you than non-organic food. And in this study, it showed that organic crops are up to 69% higher in the number of key antioxidants than conventionally grown crops. And that is really major. I mean, it's something that those of us eating organic and, you know, encouraging people to eat organic would tell you. But now we actually have a study and some science to back it up. I know, of course, GMO companies have done studies that have tried to prove that GMO crops are no worse off than organic. But that, you know, just not only is it wonderful to have the science to back it up, but also just follow your intuition. I mean, that just can't be right. And with all the toxins in our environment, what we can do and the control we can take when we are at home is really, really important. And this time of year, when you can buy so much fresh local produce, do yourself a favor and make sure that it's local and organic. Local is just not good enough. And I encourage you all to, you know, make that investment in yourself. As many of my guests have said over the years, you know, you can either pay in the front end or the back end. And it's much better to pay in the front end and keep yourself healthy than pay in the back end through medical doctors and, you know, doctor's appointments and all that. So keeping yourself healthy is really, really where it's at. You know, and I want to share with you some events coming up that can also help you in staying healthy. I, of course, am having some farm-to-table cooking classes over the summer. My next one is next Wednesday, July 23rd. There's still some space if you want to sign up. You can do that at ieatgreen.com. This class is, you know, the theme of this next class is fresh, local, but also Mediterranean flair. So using the freshest of ingredients, really simply prepared and delicious. We'll be doing some grilling. You know, dessert on the grill is always a wonderful thing, and something people don't think of very often. And the classes are just really, really fun. It's an opportunity to get your hands dirty, work in the kitchen with some other wonderful people that you'll meet, and then sit down to a beautiful, convivial, family-style meal together. And so if you can make it, the next one's July 23rd, then I also have one August 6th and August 20th. Plus, I have an extra one on July 27th. I am sponsoring, along with Dr. Nikki, a yoga and farm-to-table cooking retreat. And that's going to be out here at the IE Green Homestead in Old Westbury. It's from 11 to 4. And it starts with yoga and a guided meditation, then a mindful walk through the gardens, a nutrition discussion, on-site harvesting, group cooking, poolside lunch, and time in a pool, if you so desire. So that's going to be a full day, and you can also sign up from that from my Facebook page. So check that out. Also in the news, Carlo Bottini, who is the founder of Slow Food, is a great advocate for traditional foods and supporting local food traditions and the conviviality around eating together. And he's just, you know, been working tirelessly for years and has led the international movement of slow food for 25 years now. And it was just really wonderful that he's recognized by the United Nations in Turin last week. And another thing in the news is the neocotinoids, which I know I've talked about many times in their relationship to bee claps and the decline of bee pollinators. Well, now there's also a study that's saying it's affecting our birds. And these are birds that actually eat insects and mosquitoes, and we want those birds around to keep the mosquito populations in check. So, you know, whenever you come across a petition or anything you can do to let our legislators know that we do not want to support the type of pesticides that are being used that are hurting our wildlife and ecosystems, it's really important to do that. You know, these pesticides not only affect the birds and the wildlife, but they, you know, they have a long, long string of effects through our environment and the entire ecosystem. So everything's connected, and that's the thing we always have to remember, that everything's connected, and we can't separate, you know, oh, this only hurts the bees or this only hurts the birds, because it affects everything, and everything's so connected. A couple petitions I'd like to encourage you all to sign is one to stop the filthy chicken rule, which is now trying to be pushed through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We call it the filthy chicken rule, but I'm sure it has another name. But what this is doing is it's cutting down poultry inspectors and privatizing it to industry. So that means each factory farm that produces hundreds and thousands of chickens, they will be responsible for inspecting their own chickens. And it's just impossible. I mean, if I remember correctly, the line of these chickens going past is 200 birds per minute, faster than any human could possibly inspect those birds. And there's no longer going to be USDA inspection. So really, this is not good for people. Of course, you know, I encourage you all to buy antibiotic-free, hormone-free, free-roaming organic chickens if you're going to eat chicken. But if you're not, this rule will affect you either way. So please sign that petition and let them know. So I'd like to share a couple of other events that are going on in and around the city with all of you. And hope that I will see you at some of these events. July 19th, there's a farm-to-table benefit dinner for the Sylvia Center, which is a great nonprofit down on the Lower East Side. They have a farm called Catchkey Farm, which is upstate New York in Kinderhook. And they're having a farm-to-table dinner from 6 to 9 on July 19th. You can go to thesylviacenter.org to find out more information about that. I told you about my cooking classes. July 24th, which is next Thursday, I am catering a farm-to-table dinner for a socially responsible investing evening. And what that is sponsored by Morgan Stanley, who I normally don't think of as being, you know, green and eco-friendly. But they have a group that I'm working with that is focusing on socially responsible investing. And I'm really so thrilled about that, because after seeing Bill McKibben speak last year from 350.org about the need to divest from fossil fuel companies, I really started looking into mutual funds that we had. You know, I mean, it's not like we have a lot, but we have, you know, stuff that we've put aside in our IRAs for retirement, and I had no idea what they were doing. They just were somewhere put aside. And I started looking into it, and it wasn't good. I had no clue what I was investing in. And so I felt really great to turn that around and introduce Morgan Stanley to different funds that I had heard about that were doing just socially responsible investing. They did their research and got us into funds where we made as much or more money with our money than people investing in not green and socially responsible ways. So if you want to learn about this, send me an email and I will connect you. Also coming up, Edible Manhattan, Edible East End, they have so many great things going on. Check out their websites. Edible Manhattan has a good beer event happening on July 31st from 6 to 9. Edible East End, I know, has a truck derby coming up. That's going to be really great. Another edible event, August 13th, is a seafood soiree. Just love the edible people. And, of course, the edible people picked up on our yoga and cooking retreat as well. So that was Edible Long Island. So always check out those websites. They have great things going on. They're very close to my heart, everything they're doing. Edible East End, Edible Manhattan, and Edible Brooklyn. Can't forget them. And Edible Long Island. What else? Save the date. Slow Food North Shore, which used to be Slow Food Huntington, our local Slow Food chapter on Long Island, has a bunch of events coming up. July 27th, we're celebrating the Purple Elephant Restaurant, which is one of our newest Snail of Approval restaurants. That's going to be from 6 to 8 in Northport on the harbor. Beautiful environment. Inside and outside, sit out on the deck, enjoy some local organic beers and wines, along with some great food. They also have lots of vegan options, so it's really a wonderful menu planned. Also, we are having a tea tasting at Sip Tea Lounge, which is another Snail of Approval restaurant, August 7th from 8 to 10. And Nicole Basso, the owner of the shop, will take us through basically a tea tasting flight. And with each tea, she's paired a delicious pastry. I think one is savory, the rest are sweet, to go with the tea. So that should be a really fun evening to learn about teas. And then a members only event that we're having, which we haven't had before, but we really wanted to celebrate and welcome all of our members and new members and old members together at a potluck at a poolside home in the North Shore. So that's August 17th, and that should be a really fun evening. So if you're not a member yet, please sign up or sign up to come, and you can join there. And that is it for now. I want to share my recipe with you before I invite Nicholas Freudenberg on to share with us the wonderful work that he's doing. So the recipe that I came up with this week is a tofu rhubarb ratatouille. And, you know, this is really, honestly, my first experience cooking with rhubarb in a savory way. And there was an article, I believe by Melissa Clark in the New York Times dining section a few weeks ago about using rhubarb in a savory way, and it just inspired me. So this is my tofu rhubarb ratatouille. And I start with one block of organic sprouted firm tofu or extra firm tofu. And I've been buying the sprouted tofu. I just know when you buy things that are sprouted, they're alive and they're more vibrant and they have a little bit more nutritional value. So if you can look for the sprouted tofu, I think that's a good way to go. I cut it into thirds. I cut the block into thirds and lay it out on some clean dish towels and soak up some of the water. Then I cut it into cubes, laid it out on a baking sheet that I first covered with some olive oil, and I tossed the tofu with some garlic powder, some oregano, some salt, and some pepper. And I baked that in an oven at 375 degrees for 15 minutes until the tofu started to get golden brown, then I pulled it out. And the other things you'll need for this recipe, you need one large onion diced, two scallions, one tablespoon cut of a cup of olive oil, I'm sorry, two tablespoons olive oil, I don't know where the cup came from, two carrots diced, one rhubarb, four stalks of rhubarb chopped, one fennel sliced into thin shreds, two stalks of celery chopped, one green pepper diced, one large or two small zucchinis diced, one small eggplant diced, four white mushrooms sliced, two portobello mushrooms sliced and halved, one tablespoon chopped garlic, two teaspoons oregano, one large teaspoon of honey, and that just cuts the sourness of the rhubarb, one half cup of white wine, one quarter teaspoon red pepper flakes, feel free to use a half teaspoon if you like it a little spicy, a pint of cherry tomatoes or grape tomatoes cut in half, a quarter cup of chopped parsley, and a teaspoon of salt. And you can tell by the ingredients, like four white mushrooms. That's what I had in my refrigerator at the time. A small eggplant. If I had two eggplants, I would have used two. But my eggplants are slow to produce. They're coming, though, so I had one small eggplant to use. So anyway, while the tofu is cooking in the oven, you take out a heavy stock pot, and you're going to start by sautéing the onions and the scallions in the 2 tablespoons of olive oil. And do that until the onions become translucent. Then add the other vegetables that take a little longer to cook, which is the carrots, the fennel, the rhubarb, and the celery. And continue sautéing that for about 5 more minutes. Then add the eggplant, the peppers, and the zucchini, and cook for about 5 more minutes. Add the garlic and tomatoes. One thing I want to mention about the garlic, if you caught my show last week, I had Joe Robinson on, who wrote the book Eat Wild, and she had some great tips in there. And one of the tips was how to deal with garlic, and that there's an enzyme in garlic that if you cook garlic right when you chop it, there's an enzyme that kills the healing properties of the garlic. However, if you chop the garlic and wait 10 minutes before cooking it, those enzymes are no longer present, and the garlic retains its nutritional healthy benefits. So let that garlic sit. I actually chop a bunch of garlic, you know, when I'm doing it, and let it sit often and, you know, use it within a couple of days. And that is really great. So you're going to add the garlic and the tomatoes, then add the white wine and cook it down for about 5 minutes, scraping up the brown bits at the bottom of the pan. Then add the salt, the oregano, the honey, the parsley, and the red pepper flakes and mix well. Add the tofu to the pot and stir gently, careful not to break up the tofu. And then put a cover on it and simmer for about 15 minutes, allowing all the flavors to come together. After 15 minutes, give it a taste and adjust the spices to your liking. Like I said, you can add more red pepper flakes. You can add a little more salt if you think it needs more salt. If you like your ratatouille to be a little bit more tomato-based, you can also add a small can of diced organic tomatoes. Feel free to play around with it, as I was doing as I was creating this. But it was really great, and we ate it again last night for the second time, and my daughter was here and actually suggested melting some cheese on top, and so we did that too. So it's great vegan, and it's great, you know, au gratin. So play around with it and have fun and enjoy. So now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest, Nick Freudenberg. He's a professor at Hunter College and the City University of New York School of Public Health. And he's been working for over 30 years as a public health advocate with community groups, schools, and public agencies to help create and evaluate programs and create policies that help promote health and reduce health inequalities. His current work focuses on municipal policy responses to child obesity, which we all know is in epidemic proportions, working in different cities around the world, including New York, London, Cape Town, and Lisbon. Nick also directs the New York City Food Policy Center at Hunter College. And what we're going to be talking about is also his most recent book, which is Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. And here he examines how corporations have impacted and plagued our public health over the last century. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with my guest today, Nick Freudenberg, who is the author of a wonderful new book called Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. Nick, are you with me?
Thanks for having
wonderful.
Me.
Wonderful. I'm so sorry about the technical mix-up, but anyway, I'm glad you're with us.
Me too.
Great. So your book is just amazing. It's an issue that, you know, those of us that are always concerned about marketing and corporations and how they affect public health. You know, you've just put it all together for us, and it's really great. Can you share with us what led you to write Lethal But Legal?
Sure. I think there are really three paths to this book. The first path is as a public health researcher. I was concerned about the rise in premature death and preventable illness from chronic diseases and injuries. And I wanted to understand what had changed that these conditions, which have been around for a while, were suddenly contributing so disproportionately to the burden of illness and death, not only here in the United States, but around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second path was as a public health professional. For the past several decades, I've been developing and creating with colleagues and my students public health programs at the community level around asthma and diabetes and a variety of other problems. And repeatedly, we came up with opposition to the community health programs we were developing from special interests, from groups, businesses that profited from maintaining conditions that led to ill health. And I wanted to understand how a relatively small sector of our society, big corporations, could have such a powerful influence on blocking efforts to improve health. And then I think the third path was as an activist. I came of age in the 60s when there were active social movements, and I have grown increasingly concerned about the role of corporations, not only in affecting our health, but also undermining democracy, threatening the environment. And I wanted to see how some of the groups who were concerned about corporations could come together to have a more powerful impact.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what led me to write this book.
Yeah, well, it's so needed because people don't realize how these corporations have gotten more and more power and really, like you said, they get in the way of the initiatives that good people working on the ground level like yourself and myself are getting in the way. And it's just, you know, so frustrating. So you focus mostly on six industries: food, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, pharmaceutical, and automobiles. Can you share with us why these six and what commonalities they have?
Sure. So I think those six industries are really the mainstays of the global consumer economy. They constitute a huge part of the world economic activity, and it also happens that their products and practices are contributing to these chronic diseases and injuries that I spoke about a moment ago. And in addition, there is a public health literature that shows the role of each of these industries in premature death and preventable illness. So I wanted to understand what was similar and what was different about these six industries. Now, of course, there are other important industries that contribute to health problems, the petrochemical industry, all the energy sector. But I was looking at the consumer economy, industries that produce products that all of us use almost every day of our lives. So I
mm-hmm.
wanted to understand that. And what I found, somewhat to my surprise, that even though these six industries play a very different role in our lives, so for example, we need the food industry because we need to eat, we need the pharmaceutical industry, we certainly want to benefit from their products, whereas the firearm industry and the tobacco industry produce goods that if you use them as directed, they're lethal.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found is, despite these differences, that in fact the business and political practices of these six industries looked quite similar in their lobbying, in their marketing, in their campaign contributions. And in fact, they seemed to be following the playbook that the tobacco industry had written in the middle part of the 20th century, a playbook of denial of any problems, of using political muscle to overcome public health improvement. And so I was really thinking that we needed to think through what the appropriate public health response was to industries that were following the the plays set out by the tobacco industry.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, I've said so many times that it's good business to keep us sick and unhealthy. I mean, they all profit from it. So,
Certainly, in the short run.
If we all really get healthy, you know, it kind of puts them out of business a little bit, or it affects their bottom line. So it's to their advantage that we're sick and need all these medicines, and that we buy junk food and, you know, smoke cigarettes and shoot people.
Right.
You know, and even,
and
of course, you know, your book came out before this scandal with General Motors. You know, the timing on that is perfect.
Right, right. Disturbing, but one more illustration of an industry really covering up.
Oh, yeah.
And in this case, an industry that we, the taxpayers, have very heavily subsidized. One more example of corporate
welfare.
Right, the
bailout.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, did you find big differences between how these six industries operated? Or, like you said, I guess that they really were very similar.
Yes, I think I was more struck by the similarities. One of the things that I found particularly disturbing was the way that they related to science and the extent to which big corporations have really appropriated science and the collective wisdom of that humankind has produced to produce profits for themselves rather than to advance well-being. And even just a few decades ago, science was much more being used to advance human welfare, and the advances of in public health in the 20th century came about because of using science and technology to get clean water, safer food, cleaner air to people here and elsewhere. But if you look at the last few decades, the food industry, for example, uses evolutionary biology, neuroscience, marketing, social psychology to relentlessly promote products that we know are associated with preventable illnesses. So
right.
I think it's very upsetting that we have allowed corporations to take science for themselves rather than for humanity as a whole.
Right. Well, what so many people don't realize is that, you know, most research is happening in the universities, and corporations sponsor and support those university science programs.
That's part of the story, but I think if we look at the pharmaceutical industry, much of the research that produces the oversized profits for the pharmaceutical industry comes from taxpayer-supported research at universities. So that makes it even more upsetting that they're using that that support to produce products that are needed, products that are out of reach of people, or products that aren't so needed, what are called you know, pharmaceuticals to solve the manufactured illnesses that they create, social phobia, male baldness. You know, those are social problems, not medical problems, but the pharmaceutical mm-hmm. industry figured they can make a profit, so they develop those products and market them heavily.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the psychological science, you know, the articles that I was reading about, you know, how much artificial something or sugar they can put in something just to that tipping point, enough to get them addicted, but not enough so that they, you know, lose any profit. You know, they just like you said, they do it down to a science, and they're really using science to market and to get us addicted to some of these
yes.
things.
And again, the reason we need to be concerned about this is that study published in the New England Journal of Medicine estimated that if present trends in obesity and diabetes continue, our children and grandchildren will have shorter lifespans than we do.
Right.
And what a terrible legacy to leave to future generations. And that really is a consequence of the transformation of our food supply that Big Food has brought about in order to make more profitable products.
Mm-hmm.
And that really shows the urgency of taking action to turn this around.
Now, in your book, you talk about corporate consumption complex.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what that is?
Yes, I modified the term from a term that Dwight Eisenhower used in his farewell speech to the nation in 1961 when he warned about the military industrial complex, which he said was a threat to our democracy as well as to world peace. And I believe in this era, the corporation complex, which is the network of big corporations, their trade associations, the banks and hedge funds that finance them, the law firms, the advertising firms, the scientists, journalists they pay for, and they have, over the last several decades, accumulated outsized influence on our politics, our society, and our economy. And what the corporate consumption complex promotes is what I call hyperconsumption, a pattern of consumption, health behaviors, lifestyle that is associated with premature death and preventable illness. And a sign of how compelling hyperconsumption is that even though we know it contributes to horrible diseases, and almost all of us have family members who have suffered from tobacco-related diseases or food-related diseases like diabetes or alcohol-related diseases or automobile deaths, that hyperconsumption lifestyle is remarkably attractive, and it seems like there is no alternative to that. And that's a sign of the power of the corporate consumption complex to get inside our minds and to make us believe that this way of living is the only thing that's available in the 21st century. And that's, I think, the problem we need to overcome if we're going to begin to create a healthier nation and a healthier world.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any trends towards changing that or turning that around? What do you propose in your book?
Yes, I actually think that Lethal But Legal is an optimistic book. And what makes, there are two things that make me optimistic. One is the past and the other is the present. And from the past, every age confronts a set of challenges in order to maintain health. And in the last couple centuries, it was industrialization and urbanization. And social movements and reformers and some honest political leaders figured out how we can come together to overcome those challenges and create a healthier society. And so the remarkable advances in public health in the 20th century came about because together people were able to bring about changes and to really control the practices of business. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control put out a publication a few years ago called The Great Triumphs of Public Health of the 20th Century, and 7 of 10 of those involved changing how businesses did their work in order to prevent tobacco-related deaths, food poisoning, and so on. And so we need to figure out what are those successes for the 21st century. We've done it before. We can do it again. And what also makes me optimistic is there are literally thousands of organizations and millions of people around the world already involved in changing corporate practices in order to protect health, the environment, democracy, to reduce the sky-high levels of inequality that corporations are causing. And so the problem, I think, is that all those individuals and organizations working for change have been too much working in their own little sector, have been too much doing their own thing. And what I propose in the book is finding ways that we can bring together the efforts to improve health, to improve the environment, to restore democracy. And mm-hmm. I suggest some of the particular issues that I think can move us in that direction.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's an issue that I hear coming up so often, and I talk about it as well, because, you know, I guess I'm focused more on, you know, the food issues. And there are so many organizations, even just within Long Island and the New York area, that are working towards, you know, community gardens and promoting good health and school lunch programs and gardens in schools. And there's so many people doing somewhat similar things, that if we all pooled our energy together, we actually could move forward, it feels like, you know? Instead of so many people doing this similar things, we could, you know, if we could find a way to work together. So how do you propose working together in your book?
Well, I think there are some issues that bring together these, you know, the people working on food and the people working on tobacco, but also the people working on the environment, on health, on democracy, on inequality. One of them is to insist that corporations have an obligation to disclose what they know about the products they make and the practices they use, and that citizens, residents, consumers have the right to know. And I think that's something that could really bring together a wide variety of people. We've seen with the tobacco industry, when people learned about the deception of the tobacco industry as a result of the documents that were required to be revealed as a result of the litigation and the settlement between the attorneys general of the states and the tobacco industry, it was much easier to pass legislation to restrict the tobacco industry. So I think getting that information out is really important.
So like right now with GMOs, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of people that think GMOs are really bad, and then there's some people that are saying that, you know, that are connected to the corporations saying that they're just fine, there's no difference. And, you know, over 90% of Americans want labeling. They just want the right to know. And our government, it seems like right now, they're trying to pass legislation through Congress that won't even allow states to require labeling on their foods.
Yes.
I mean, how do you get around
Vermont
that?
Recently.
I mean, here is our country, our legislation. 90% of Americans want the right to know. They want it. They're not saying, you know, they're not saying make GMOs illegal, which I think would be a wonderful thing. They're just saying, let us know so we can make informed choices. And they're, you know, they're saying they don't want to, that that's going to plug into people's fear and make them think that something's wrong with GMOs, so they
right.
are pushing not to.
Right, right. I was in Vermont recently where the Vermont
yeah.
legislature passed and the governor signed mandatory labeling of GMOs, and they were immediately sued by Monsanto and some of the other big producers. But I think in that fight, history is on our side. You know, we had the same objection to any restrictions on the tobacco industry, and it took a long time. And unfortunately, the time it takes is time that people are exposed to potentially hazardous substances or products. But I think we will see progress on mandatory labeling.
Mm-hmm. I hope you're right. I mean, I just heard
issue.
That Hillary Clinton, you know, came out in big support of the GMOs, and she's very connected to Monsanto and the biotech companies. And, you know, her take on it was, you know, we just have to get the science right and get people to know, what did she say? She actually said, a better vocabulary to change negative public perception about GMO agriculture.
Right. I was talking about some of the policy agendas, political strategies that could bring people together. And I think a second one is to remove the right of corporations to pass on to their consumers and the taxpayers the cost of the harm that their products do. And we saw, again, using the case of the tobacco industry, that when they were required to pay billions of dollars to reimburse states for the cost of tobacco-related illness, that made them a little more cautious. I think on the tobacco front, there is more progress to be made. But I think in the case of General Motors and this recent really tragedy about their covering up a problem with ignition, in the case of the food industry and the relationship of products like soda and fast food to diet-related diseases like diabetes, where taxpayers and American families are footing the bill for their dangerous practices. And
right.
I think that's an issue that where we can bring people together. And it will be a fight, and we're not going to win in a year or two or five. But I think these battles we've seen from the past they're marathons, they're not sprints. And so we need to be preparing for a long fight, but I think the vast majority of the people, the 99%, will benefit from those changes, and the 1% are more powerful today, but we've seen before how people have come together and expanded democracy and won important reforms.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really wonderful that you're able to see the optimism in it, because it's, you know, and you're still out there, you know, doing the work. I mean, so many people who kind of were with you in the 60s seem to have gone into those corporations and disappeared from doing the work. You know, I mean, there's certainly some of us still around, but, you know, it's hard. That hyper-consumption complex that you talk about can get contagious, and for so many it becomes, you know, almost an illness in itself.
Right, right. And I think that this corporate consumption complex that I write about spends a lot of time and effort and money having us believe that there is no alternative. You know, Maggie Thatcher, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, said there is no alternative to modern capitalism. And I think the message that we need to give back, and we being public health and nutrition and food people, social activists, scientists, is another world is possible. And I think when people come to believe that another world is possible, that their day-to-day actions can lead to that different world, then they're able to stay in it for the long term. So I think that's the message we need to give, and that's what we need to show people in a day-to-day way, how they can make their communities a little bit safer, how they can increase the chances that their children will be and grandchildren will be healthy. And that's contagious, too. You know, another mm-hmm. world is possible is a contagious idea.
I love that. So in the book, you also talk about you link the struggles to change corporate practices that harm health to other business practices that damage the environment, undermine democracy, and promote inequality. Can you share with us that connection?
Sure. So I think let's start with the environment. And one of the biggest threats to the survival of both humanity and the world as we know it is human-induced climate change. And many of the same factors that are driving climate change are also contributing to the health problems. The heavy reliance on automobiles instead of either mass transportation or active transportation, walking, biking, and so on. Our agricultural system of using industrial-scale agriculture and producing huge amounts of methane as a result of increasing reliance on an animal and a meat diet instead of a mixed animal meat, the omnivore diet. So I think the benefits of promoting the alternatives to automobile transportation, heavy meat, industrial processed food diet are both better health and a reduction in global warming and production of carbon. So I think we need to do much more to both educate people and to find ways to bring people together. So the September demonstration against human climate change in New York City at the United Nations is an example where many people from the food movement will be going to talk about the role of food production in climate change and strategies for having alternatives to that. That's a concrete way that these two movements can come together. On the democracy side, I think one of the reasons that people concerned about health have had such a hard time winning victories is that the political playing field is not level. Big corporations have won really unprecedented power to influence our legal system. We have the most corporate-friendly Supreme Court in the last 50 years. The legislative system, where McDonald's and General Motors have far more representatives in Congress as a result of their campaign contributions than the people of New York or California or Texas. In the White House, where even the threat of withholding support from a Democratic or a Republican president can lead to changes in policy, so that undermining of democracy is really something that we in public health and in the food movement need to take on, because it's what's preventing us from being able to win victories. And so whether that's reversing Citizens United, you know, the Supreme Court decision that considers
allows corporations
that protects political speech of corporations, or whether it's the campaign reforms that have been proposed, or the restrictions on lobbying, or closing the revolving door between industry, those are political reforms that will make it easier to protect public health. And on the income inequality, which I think is really the burning issue of today, the issue that this country needs to address if we're going to restore prosperity that has been so damaged by the 2008 economic crisis. We're going to need to take on the increasing concentration of wealth, not only in the 1%, but the 0.1 and the 0.01%. And that concentration of wealth is primarily in the people who own and run corporations. And so their ability to set the terms, the political terms, will only contribute to rising inequality. And so we really need to take that on as a core of our political system. So those are some of the connections I see. And of course, we're taking on the most powerful players in the history of the world, these big multinational corporations. But the good news, I think, is there are relatively few of them. There may be 1,000, 2,000 corporations that make the vast bulk of what individuals consume in the six industries I talk about, and that account for the really the lion's share of global wealth. And so we need to find ways to have a much stronger oversight of those corporations, and to say that it's people and the governments that people take control of that set the terms between markets and business, that it's not a market responsibility to set the ground rules for society as a whole.
Right. But that requires mobilizing people. I mean, we have the numbers of people way outnumber the amount of corporations, but you know, it seems to me that there's just so much apathy and people just so busy just trying to get by. And you know, that's one thing that I think technology, as wonderful as computers and all that is, it also it eats people's time. I was just talking to my daughter yesterday about, you know, how much time it takes just to stay on top of all the marketing she's doing for herself, whether it's, you know, Facebook and, you know, and Twitter and Instagram, like all, you know, so much time young people and everybody spends to everybody that's getting in touch with them with the computers and all the different emails that you get. And I mean, it's overwhelming. And so no one has any time left to be active and to do things.
Right, right. The way I think about it is corporations have really come to occupy our minds, and we need to find ways to evict them. And a big part of corporation success is that they've made children and young people the chief marketing officer in every household, the people who know about new products and, you know, nag, persuade, whatever strategy they use, their parents and their household to consume those products. But I think there's another side to that, and I think the social media and new forms of technology also offer an alternative, a way for those people who are opposed to the corporate consumption complex to be in touch with each other, to unite, and that this interconnected world is also a liability, a vulnerability for the big corporations, because they are very dependent on their image and on the support. And that image is very vulnerable. as a result of the internet and so on. And so I think we will be able to use that. Great. We'll be able to use that to reach out to people. And it's not, it's a necessary part of the strategy. It's not sufficient because people are not going to be able to win sitting at their keyboard. They're going to need to be out in the streets and active and in the shopping malls and the schools and the community centers and the town halls. But we need to find ways to use those new technologies to reach people and to activate them, as you say.
Right, and to mobilize. I mean, I loved, the Occupy movement that was happening. It just was, for me, it was just so wonderful to see people hitting the streets and coming together in that way. And, you know, it's sad to me that we kind of lost that momentum because I felt like it was really, attracting
but
attention.
But I think what the Occupy movement accomplished is it changed the political conversation and it put inequality squarely on the agenda. And that centrality of inequality helped New York City elect a different mayor than it might have elected otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
It helped Barack Obama, fairly or not, win the 2012 election. And so even a very evanescent movement was able to bring about big changes. And think about if that movement had a little sticking power and if we learn the lessons from what didn't work about Occupy and can make that into a stickier movement with a longer lifespan, how much we'll be able to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you so much for the work you're doing. It's so important. And also for mentioning to everyone listening about the People's Climate March that's happening on September 21st at the United Nations in the city. It's going to be the biggest march around. And I was actually at a wonderful meeting yesterday where we just formed the Long Island Food Coalition for our first time, just made it official. And we're going to have a food conference in 2015 that's going to be really big and rock. But meanwhile, the idea of forming this food coalition is to try to bring all different food organizations and healthcare organizations and people caring about the environment to this climate march on September 21st.
Terrific.
Yeah. So thank you so much. Before we go, can you tell people where they can get your book and learn more about the work that you're doing?
Sure. The book is called Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. It's published by Oxford University Press. It's available from Oxford, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online booksellers. It's also available in most bookstores. And the website is www.lethalbutlegal.org, www.lethalbutlegal.org. And I'm also the director of the New York City Food Policy Center at Hunter College, and that's www.nycfoodpolicy.org. And I thank you for having me on today.
You're so welcome. I admire the work that you're doing so much. It's so needed, and I hope our paths cross again really soon.
Me too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And everybody out there listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today has been Nicholas Freudenberg from New York City Public Health at Hunter College. Thanks so much. Have a great day.